White House and debating on the Hill. Of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants and Old Glory will be furled. Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world. And a bill will be proposed, section number one. We're shutting down the oil rigs and turning towards the sun. The air will be clean for all the boys and girls, cause we don't want your oil tankers, we just want the world. Face the executioner, shut the logging camps all down. Get busy planting hemp, leave the trees there in the ground. Life is too precious on this little spinning pearl, cause we don't want your bulldozers, we just want the world. We'll be closing down the jails and fixing up the schools, distributing those stocks and bonds, changing all the rules. We'll elect a CEO, maybe a rabbit or a squirrel, cause we don't want your money, we just want the world. Be swimming in the rivers and running to the hills, reading in the history books of wars and oil spills. If it's linear, we'll bend it. If it's a straight line, it'll curl. Cause we don't want your dead-end highway, we just want the world. When we're living in the White House and debating on the Hill, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants and Old Glory will be firm. Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Happy birthday, Elizabeth Warren. Her birthday is June 22nd. Elizabeth Ann Warren is an American academic and politician and senior United States Senator from Massachusetts and a member of the Democratic Party. Elizabeth was previously a Harvard Law School professor specializing in bankruptcy law. Elizabeth is an active consumer protection advocate whose work led to the conception and establishment of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
You know, I want to say a little bit about my own journey into public service. I was not a little girl who thought someday I want to be president or someday I want to be senator. I was actually a little girl who did have aspirations, ambitions. I wanted to be a school teacher, and I was pretty cool. And the journey that took me here is the most improbable of journeys. I was someone, I married at 19. I had my first baby at 21. I started law school on Amelia's second birthday. It was a big event. I kept explaining to her about how mommy was going to go to school and she was going to go to school, and potty training was the thing that stood between us and success. And we got there together. And so all this ended up, I went from being a public school teacher to going to law school with one little one, spent a summer on Wall Street, my second summer of law school, taking the train. I remember how serious I felt. I would get on the train with all these men to ride into Wall Street. We were living out in New Jersey. And I got pregnant my third year in law school, graduated from law school, enormous, and didn't take a job because you couldn't get a job if you were pregnant. I thought that the 3 years I'd spent in law school were gone. I'd stepped off a career track that was really not open to women. And I thought I'd given it all up because I was now going to be home with two babies. And I went ahead, took the bar exam. I was the first nursing mother to take a bar exam in the state of New Jersey. Try explaining that 1,000 times to the proctors. But we made it through, and I actually went into solo law practice. I still have a shingle that says, black with white letters on it, Elizabeth Warren, and then in italics, attorney at law. It still hangs on my wall because it meant about you pull yourself up and you do what you can. My law school, Rutgers, called me back to teach, so I really was going to get to be a school teacher again. One thing led to another, and I ended up with a permanent teaching job down in Houston, where my husband had been transferred. And there I was. I was a young mother. I had two little kids. I was struggling with daycare, trying to figure out. I was one of those people who lived out in the suburbs, and I passed. I was teaching at the University of Houston. When people would ask me, if I worked, I would always say, yes, I teach. And they'd say, what? And I'd say, first years. To which people would say, oh, they're so cute at that age. And I'd always just smile. They are. It's true. And there I was in an all-male environment. It was then an all-male profession. And I had picked out an all-male area that I like to work in, which is commercial and business law, where the money is. And so here I am struggling to teach. I'm reading the stuff, trying to stay just about a half a step ahead of my students. And I knew that I had to do research. I'd be perfectly honest, not having grown up in a very fancy law school or a very fancy undergraduate school, I wasn't entirely sure what it was all about, other than I'd seen a little of it when I'd been on Law Review, a little of what you needed to piece together. So I thought, you need a question to look at and to start doing some research on how it works. And there was a new law in place, the new bankruptcy laws, and I thought, I know what I'll look into. Who files for bankruptcy and why? There was a lot of conversation just starting. Remember, this is the early 1980s, late 70s, early 1980s, that it was unscrupulous people who were taking advantage, running up bills and then dashing into bankruptcy and discharging them. And that's how I got started in my first bit of research and my first empirical studies. And it turned out to be a very sobering journey, because where I ended up was in a world in which, let's just start right there when I was at the beginning getting started. Bankruptcy filings over the next 20 years doubled and doubled again and went up again. We reached a point where women in that period of time, over a 20-year period, the increase in the number of women filing for bankruptcy went up 662%. By the early 2000s, an adult woman was more likely to file for bankruptcy than she was to graduate from college. For many people, and I should point out about this, and women with children, about four times more likely to file for bankruptcy than those without children, than married couples, than men. So what did that mean? Chronic poverty issues, is that what we're talking about? No, actually we weren't. In the mix of women, of married couples, of single men who filed for bankruptcy, by and large, it was a profoundly middle-class group. As a group, compared with the rest of the population, folks in bankruptcy had gone to college, they'd gotten decent jobs, they'd bought homes, many of them had started families, and yet something had gone terribly wrong in their lives. So wrong that we reached a point that now more than 1 million families every year find themselves in bankruptcy. So this led me, I started my studies with bankruptcy and then just kept working backwards. How much it's happening, to whom it's happening, America's middle class, what has gone so profoundly wrong that would cause so many families to file for bankruptcy? And keep in mind, for every family in bankruptcy, there are many more tottering right on the edge, not having filed, put it off, as more than one family who ended up in one of our studies, committing suicide rather than taking that step. So bankruptcy becomes a little like the like a medicine. The notion we will dissect the bodies to discover where illness is in the population generally, and that's basically what I did with the bankruptcy data. Just kept backing it up on who's there.
Here are great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some gold.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
Let's send them back.
Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid? Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
And now back to Elizabeth Warren.
And basically, here was the story that unfolded. It's a pretty straightforward story. The American middle class has been hit by a 1-2-3 punch. The first one, rising core expenses. You know, every time someone does adjusted for inflation, unpack those numbers and look at the parts that are flexible spending, the kind of things you can cut back on if somebody loses a job or you're a little tight this month, and look at the part that's relentless, the big core fixed expenses that happen month after month. Mortgage, healthcare, transportation expenses, child care if you have young children or are trying to work. These were the expenses that went up for families, while families cut back on everything else, on food, on clothing, on appliances, on furniture. It was not the picture of overconsumption that you read about in books like Luxury Fever or The Overspent American. It was a picture of families who did everything they could to cut back on expenses. But over time, what was happening is the core fixed expenses, the kind of expenses that make us middle class, health insurance that you can count on if someone gets sick, a mortgage on a home. And let me point out, for those of you who are sitting there saying, oh, but homes got bigger, got fancier, spa bathrooms and granite countertops. We're talking about median families here. For the median family in the United States in this same time period, houses got about 10% bigger and they got 25 years older. The typical family over this 20-year period, 25-year period, picked up either a second bathroom or a third bedroom, but not both. So at the median, what we're talking about are families who paid much more just to hang on to what was the typical place in the middle class. That's number one. Number two is they just got hit with flat wages. You know, if we drew a picture of what wages looked like in the United States and we mapped it against GDP, if I'd known we had a great screen, I actually would have brought my slides on this, and then you all could have rested. I know what students are like. So you start post-World War II, and basically what happens is GDP and inflation-adjusted wages just move together. In other words, what's happening is every year that goes by, the pie is getting bigger. And so the slice that goes to wages, the part that we get to eat that, you know, buys our houses and pays for our health insurance, is bigger because it's a proportionate piece of an ever bigger pie. And you start somewhere around the mid to late 70s, and the two curves start to diverge. And GDP, God bless it, takes a sharper upward trajectory. And a fully employed male flatlines. So that today, a fully employed male in the United States, median earner, adjusted for inflation, makes less than his father made a generation ago. That's what happened on the wage front. Families responded by doing the typical things. They quit saving. They sent a second earner, if they had a second earner, into the workforce, so they became two-income families wherever they could. And now here comes the real third punch. They turned to debt. It just happens that in 1980, basically, we can go through the details, we deregulated the credit industry. So if you think of consumer credit, right, whether it's mortgages, credit cards, short-term cash loans, car loans, whatever you're talking about, let me just explain it this way. There are three time periods in America, in the world, on consumer credit. The first time period goes from the 14th century BC Code of Hammurabi. Really? Usury. There shall be no usury, right? And we put usury caps in place. If you think about it, it's the very first consumer protection that I know of in the history of humankind. So, usury laws. That period extends to 1980. Yep. In 1980, with no public debate, and I'm glad to do the details, but effectively, we pretty much repealed the usury laws. We kind of did it in two bites, and no real debate over it, got rid of them. And that started the period from 1980 to 2010. And that was the period, in effect, of the Wild West. And what happened during that period is that we ended up with families at the very moment that they were turning to debt in order to pay for college educations, something that had another one I should have mentioned in terms of costs rising significantly. At the same moment that they turned to debt to deal with medical problems that they couldn't pay for, at the same moment that they turned to debt to deal with unemployment, at the same moment that they turned to debt just to try to make it to the end of the month, the debt industry became far more dangerous than it had ever been in our history. So here's what happened. It used to be the case that creditors effectively screened their borrowers. They looked at them to see if they thought there was a pretty good likelihood they would repay. And they said, in effect, we'll figure out our business model based on that. We'll screen the borrowers carefully. We charge a premium for risk. We charge something for the time value of money. We put something in for the risk of inflation. We put a little something in for our profits. And we're done. That's what the business is about. And people who are good at screening will do well in this business, and people who are bad at it in either direction will be washed out of the industry. It was really a very virtuous cycle in terms of reinforcing itself. But there were lenders who figured out a very different model. And that was a model that said, wait a minute, we think there's a better way to make the profits. We can make profits on penalty rates. We can make profits on repricing. We can make profits on fees. In fact, we can make such extraordinary profits if we set this up right that we actually can make a profit even if you end up defaulting on the loan. We can make so much money in the upfront, particularly at a time over the last few years when the cost of funds was very low, we can make so much money that we will be repaid on extraordinarily risky loans. We'll make our money back after a few months, and shoot, the rest is just an annuity. Just count on raking in the money. So what happened after a while was that we ended up with a credit industry that fundamentally changed. And it changed in the following way. In the same way that I described a fairly virtuous circle that was pretty easy to understand, it switched over to a market in which it was all about upfront marketing, is pretending to sell at a low, low price, knowing that if I can get you in the door, I will be able to extract incredible fees and repricing on the interest rates so that I will make all my money on the back end. So it becomes a front-end, back-end game to get people in the door. And that meant obscuring costs for the customer, making these ever more complicated arrangements so that it's very difficult to compare one product to another. What happened? Credit cards led the way. A credit card agreement, Bank of America's credit card agreement, in 1980 was just a little under a page and a half long. That was the whole deal, the entire contract. That ballooned to an average of about 30 pages a couple of years ago. 30 pages of what the industry refers to as mice type. Words that are designed not to be read. That's the point. Let's just be serious. Look at it. What does it scream? Do not read me. You could die if you read this. We will kill brain cells, anyone who enters here. Right? It's written obscurely. It's written in small language. It's written in long sentences. Everything to obscure what the arrangement is about. And I want to make a real point about, a little point off to the side, about all of the fine print, as we've come to call it, that's been put in these contracts. Great place to hide things, right? It's like shrubbery for the muggers. Who knows what's back there? Most of it's probably perfectly benign. But you can't tell, and that's really the point. Slip in a clause here, add a little penalty fee over there, an extra expense over here, and it's all lost in a sea of words, words, words. Credit card companies weren't the only ones, though. Others began to follow. The idea of a teaser rate credit card, we will give it away for free, right, or almost free, 2.99%, you've seen these over and over, gave way after a few years to a teaser rate mortgage. The idea that we will lend you a mortgage that we know, based on the financial information you have given us, will, at the end of 2 years, cost you your home if you are unable to refinance this mortgage and pay additional thousands of dollars of fees. And that was a business model that was enormously profitable. Now, I want to be clear as we go through this, when we talk about what went wrong in this industry and what's gone wrong in the last decade, there's plenty of room to talk about borrower irresponsibility as well. Borrowers took on too much credit. There's no doubt about that. And in some cases, it was people who were heedless. It was people who said, you know, I'm going to the mall. I got plastic. As long as they'll give it to me, I'm going to go spend it. But we have to keep in mind that this was an era in which ordinary market competition simply did not work. Credit card tricks and traps generated billions of dollars for the issuers. And risky mortgages injected so much risk into the economy, it nearly brought us to our knees. There was an industry that profited beyond all dreams in selling people on borrowing money. And so were we fallible? Yes, we were fallible. But there were people who made billions from taking advantage of our fallibility. So this is where we were a few years ago. I looked around, and I have to tell you, I was terrified.
If you've got the mic, then it's all okay. It's all okay, 'cause if it makes it the same as you.
Now for something completely different.